This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who enjoys a good book. Coming to you from Tantalk Radio Network Studio here in glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. And oh, wow, what a day. I just got back from Madison, Wisconsin. And believe me, I love Florida. I will. People are crazy. I can't. I was so cold. I was like in shock. It was actually colder there at one point. I think it was negative 17. Then colder than my freezer. So I am very, very happy to be back. And I have lots of things coming up. It's just coming up to the fourth anniversary of Joy on Paper, and I'm really excited about that. And I want to thank all of you who are sending emails to me because and congratulating me, and all of your cards also. Thank you very much. I have a wonderful guest today. It's really exciting. As all of my listeners know, I was involved in writing a script for a book by Walt Cunningham. An Apollo astronaut, and I've always been interested in space, and I am so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper today Rod Pyle, who, I don't know, he's an expert in space. He's done, I don't know how many books already, I've lost count, but I'm so excited to have Rod here today to talk about his newest book, Space 2.0, How Private Spaceflight, Resurgent NASA, and international partners are creating a new space age. Whoa, a long title. Hi, Rod.
Good morning, Patsy with a Z. How are you?
Okay, I'm fine. Big title, great book. Unbelievable. The photos are great. The factoids are... You know, as I mentioned to you when before, I've been a space fan for years. And then having the opportunity, as I did, to meet and so many of the astronauts when I visited Johnson Space Center and got the behind-the-scenes tour. So your books are just fantastic, and it's a exciting field, isn't it?
It is, and I just had the privilege of spending some time with Walt Cunningham and some of his colleagues in beautiful Des Moines, Iowa, where it was 7 above, but still, I drove from L.A. to Tucson, where the book festival was, and it was 80 degrees, and then I got on a plane and flew that night to Des Moines, where it was 7, so while it wasn't as cold as it was where you were, it was enough for this to be in California, for sure.
Yes, for people from California and Florida, it's a shock to our system.
it's kind of like walking into a glass wall that's just extremely frigid. So yeah, it was really nice. I hadn't met Walt before, except in passing. So it was nice to spend some time. And Al Worden and Fred Hayes and Jerry Griffin were there, too. So it was really fun. And they're just, you know, those guys were a joy to hang out with because they're, I'm a little bit of a fanboy, so I just kind of want to sit there and absorb the radiance for a while. But just being able to talk to them about those times back in the 1960s when we were flying, late in that decade, we were flying missions to the moon as often as every 10 weeks in some cases. It's kind of hard to get your head wrapped around today.
It was an exciting time, and though it's hard to believe what a short window it was from 1969 to 1972, where we were really, you know, going to the moon. It's just so, it's still so exciting to say that, isn't it?
It really is, and I think it's funny, I was mentioning to the astronauts when we were doing our panel, I said, you know, it's been almost as long since the first moon landing within a handful of years as that was from the first flight of the Wright brothers. When you put it in that context, it feels like we've been a little slower since then. But I think, you know, part of that is because our priorities shifted and, you know, the taxpayers were tired of supporting this very expensive program and so forth. But I think part of it also is Apollo, as has been said by much smarter people than me, was almost as if Kennedy reached in the future and sort of pulled a piece of the 21st century back in the 1960s. But another way of looking at that is that we were flying way beyond the edge of what we should have been capable of doing at the time, and it was incredibly dangerous. And we are so fortunate that we never lost anybody out there. It blows my mind to this day.
It is. When having been behind the scenes there at Johnson Space Center and spending time with Alan Bean and some of the other astronauts, on the one hand, they're just ordinary guys. They're fun to hang out with. But then when you realize how very brave they were, I mean, what they did, so few people could actually do that. And you're sitting there, you're talking to them, and you say, well, they're just ordinary guys. But they get on top of a rocket and go to, it's still mind-boggling.
It is, and they were trained mercilessly to be successful at what they did and to be able to adapt and manage under crisis conditions when and if they occurred. And, again, you look at that technology, and while it was extremely capable, it was fairly primitive by our standards. Very low-powered computers, very power-hungry electronics, and the kind of rudiments of a life support system, which worked perfectly for both the suits and the spacecraft, but it was the first time we'd ever done anything like that for extended times. I mean, submarines have been going underwater for a long time, but you're not packing up all that equipment and sticking a little tiny version of it in a spaceship that heads off to the moon. And submarines can surface. Spaceships can't come home that quickly. So you're right. I mean, they're incredibly brave, and I'm a guy who can't even stand being in an elevator too long, so I'm not quite sure.
Oh, that's me too.
A space capsule for 2 weeks, shoulder to shoulder. It's just mind-boggling. And now we're kind of heading back. And interestingly, we're heading back out in a fashion that's a lot closer to Apollo than it is the space shuttle. This new space age is starting to look very familiar in terms of hardware to people of a certain age, and I found that really compelling.
Well, it's so funny when you see the computers that they had back in those days. You just are amazed that they could get them to the moon. I mean, they look so primitive today. I think our iPhone has as much power as some of those computers. So
there's an even better statistic for that. I heard from, I think it was Jerry Griffin said the other day, who's in a position. No, sorry, it was Alan Stern. I was on a panel with Alan Stern in Tucson. He was the guy in charge of the New Horizons probe out to Jupiter. And we were talking about the iPhone and computing back in the day, and I said something like, my understanding is the average iPhone 7 has more computing power than NASA did in the 1960s. And he said, actually, that iPhone in your pocket has more computing power than the entire world had in 1965. I thought, well, boy, that's an even better statistic, and he's in a position to know it because he's very smart. So, yeah, it's pretty remarkable. The computer that flew the lunar module and the command module out to the moon had 36K of memory operating at, I don't remember, 1/10 of a megahertz or something. I mean, it was kilohertz. It was tiny and very low powered, but it was enough. And the programming is very simple. And if you got lost out there, you got out your telescope, which was built into the command module, and you looked through the lenses, and you found a couple of stars, and you fixed your position just like the navigators of old seafaring nations, and you're back in business. So they figured it all out in a pretty miraculous way.
It is. Well, now the new book, of course, is How Private Spaceflight and Resurgent NASA and International Partners Are Creating a New Space Age. It is so fascinating. The book is, one thing I love about the book, this is a book that is accessible to everyone. Everyone will enjoy it. As I said, the photos are great and all the facts that you put in are great. And I'm, for myself, I don't know if I'm xenophobic or cheap, but I have hated paying the Russians to take our guys up to space. And I was so happy when, we're getting back in the game and we're going to be in charge of our missions.
Yeah, in a whole new way. And I mean, and I'm with you that initially when we stopped flying the shuttle, the agreement with the Russians was going to be, I think it was $36 million per seat to get up the space station, which we paid for most of, by the way. with our astronauts. Now it's up over 80. So that's a bit of a price increase in a handful of years. On the other hand, if you ignore the cargo carrying capacity of the shuttle, it was still cheaper than flying people on the shuttle. So, you know, it's kind of a split two ways. But I'm with you. You know, we should be flying our people on our own hardware. And it's been a long road. NASA cut this deal with SpaceX and Boeing many years ago, and I think it was supposed to start flying in 2015. So there's been a lot of delays. Part of it's because it was never completely funded by Congress to the levels that it was supposed to be. So that was part of the problem. This all began under the Obama administration. But they've gotten there. And as you know, SpaceX flew just a few days ago their final test run before sending up humans to the space station on their rocket. And Boeing should be flying in a couple of weeks. So I think we're back.
Oh, it is a good thing because I'm always mystified when people say, oh, why go to space, why bother, I can't understand it, because to me it's so exciting to do this, and we have all so many of our developments have become as a result of this kind of thinking that we want to get better, get smaller, get all of that.
Yeah, that's why I devoted a whole chapter in Space 2.0 to why space, because that's a discussion that we've been having since 1961. And NASA has spent many years trying to champion their position, but it's always indirect benefit. It's how many people did this get inspired to go into space and technology and engineering and science? What are the profound spinoffs in the space program? The computer in your iPhone, kidney dialysis machines. There's a ton of things. There's a publication they do, I think, quarterly called NASA Spinoffs that detail all this and has been since the 1960s. But it's still a hard sell because they're kind of indirect benefits, and you have to follow a certain thread of logic to get back to the beginning of them to say, oh, I see. And a lot of people just don't want to bother. I think what is going to make a difference, and that's what's happening now, is when commercial interests say, hey, we can make money up there, and as every good American knows, capitalism is kind of the core engine that runs this place that we live in. And I think that's when you start seeing some real results, when people realize there's a revenue stream to be had. And that's not been the case before, at least not with human space flight. Telecommunication satellites have been making people money since the 1960s, but we're seeing a whole kind of a new level of earnings that are beginning to come down now, and that's really exciting.
Yeah, well, they all want to get a chunk of a comet or filled with diamonds or gold or whatever. So we always have people after diamonds and gold.
Yeah, that's part of it. I mean, there are some of those platinum and other precious metals in a number of the asteroids, we think. But there's also rare earth elements. So right now, the United States spends a lot of money buying the weirdo rare earth elements from China, which has most of them, just by virtue of having those ores in their soil. And there's a lot of that out. Because when you think about it, the stuff that's floating around out there in the asteroid belt and closer to Earth with near-Earth object asteroids are the primordial building blocks of the solar system. That's the stuff that the planets are made from, so the terrestrial planets. So if you can go out and lasso one of those things and bring it somewhere where you can actually do mining, probably robotically, you don't need to send people there for this, you can start digging up the kind of stuff that we're beginning to deplete on Earth, but there's a whole lot of it out there that's many, many, many more times all the most precious raw stuff that we seek out on the Earth floating around in space. But you have to go out and get it. That's been the hard part, It's expensive and it's difficult to do.
Well, when you were writing this book, what your goal was, what, to get people excited again about what's happening? And particularly like Elon Musk and those guys who are really moving us ahead.
That was part of it. I'd been championing the book for a number of years, and my wonderful agent, John Willig, had been doing the same. And we had a number of publishers interested, but unusually, we're having trouble kind of crossing that last 5 feet of the divide between us and closing a deal. And part of it was financial. So I went to the National Space Society, who I'd worked with for a number of years, and I now edit their magazine. At the time, I just finished doing a big video project for them. And they said, would you be interested in underwriting this? And to my very pleasant surprise, they said yes, and one gentleman named Stan Rosen actually took the bit and ran with it and raised the money, which is why it's co-published with them. And as a group, their mandate is the settlement of space with human beings, but also they're a grassroots group, so their larger mandate, I think, in many ways, is to engage the public in this conversation across the board. So that became the thrust of the book, not so much for members of that organization, but to have a conversation between that organization's mission, ideas, mission statement, and the broader public and say, look, here's why there are good reasons to be heading out into space, to be working in space, to be living in space, to be trying to utilize and develop space and its resources. This isn't just about science. This isn't just about the philosophical statements of man must explore and that kind of stuff that we heard back in the 1950s and 60s. And there is truth to that. But when you start talking about the real and tangible benefits, an example would be space solar power. You know, orbiting platforms can be in the sun 24/7, sending energy down to a single point on Earth where it's distributed. There are challenges to be overcome, many, but a number of countries, especially in Asia, are spending a lot of money on this right now. And if you can work out that technology, you're getting us off the fossil fuel standard. Wouldn't that be incredible? We're no longer polluting our atmosphere with all this CO2. So that's just one example of the many, many things that I want to communicate in the book. And that was the core of it.
Well, that one's always scared me. I imagine the energy coming down and, I don't know, a plane flying through it. I don't know. They have to figure out all of that.
Yeah, they'd have to work out a few things. I mean, you have to convince the rest of the planet that it's not going to become weaponized, and that's important. And it's not just us. You know, the Chinese are working very hard on it. Japan's been working on it for a number of years, decades, actually. And that is a problem, but it's not insurmountable. It's just the conversation that has to be had. But frankly, when you start looking at some of the alternatives, including fusion, you know, then beams coming down from orbit doesn't seem so bad in terms of the difficulty and possibly some of the potential dangers. So I think it's a net win. But you're right, we have to have a bigger conversation about that.
Well, do we know what the Chinese found on the dark side of the moon? Are they telling us? I don't know.
Yeah, there's been a fairly regular flow of news. It's much the same as here. I mean, it's not actually the dark side. It goes through phases, just like the side.
I know. I'm joking.
The dark side. It's a nice, you know, it sounds more dramatic.
Yeah,
right?
Doesn't it? It sounds good. Somehow you imagine if there are people on the moon, they'd want to be on that side more. But
well,
anyway.
You? Otherwise, you'd have to watch I Love Lucy reruns all day.
That's it.
Yeah, on the backside, you know, same as the Earth, although much more heavily bombarded. Apparently, the moon became what they call tidally locked, which just means that one side faces Earth all the time, fairly early in its history. So the backside, when there was still a lot of stuff swinging around the solar system, slamming the planet, the backside of the moon got an awful lot of that. So there's probably a slightly different mix of minerals that have been turned up in the soil. But also what they're really looking for, and I haven't heard anything on yet, is water. You know, we know there's oxygen in moon rocks. Sort of ironic that would be the case, but it is. There's silicates, some metal, but what we're really looking for on the moon is water traps. And they'll be further south and north up in the poles where there are craters that are dark all the time. But over the years, you know, comets have slammed in the moon and so forth, left water behind. And water is really valuable in space because it costs thousands of dollars a gallon to launch. Need it for drinking, you could use it to make rocket fuel, you could use it to make breathable oxygen. So if you can find that out there in some real quantities, all that is stuff you don't have to lift off of Earth, and suddenly spaceflight becomes much more affordable if you can extract that water and start processing all those things from it. So that's what we're waiting for, but we haven't heard that one yet.
So it's probably at one of the poles, right? If it's there.
That's the thought, yeah, on or near the poles, because that's where you find craters that are dark all the time and the water wouldn't have been evaporated away.
And that's where the Chinese want to build a palace?
The moon palace?
The moon palace.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. Their plans are advancing very quickly. You know, for my book, I had worked to interview a couple of people from that program, and it was very challenging. I finally did interview one gentleman that had come over to the U.S. years ago, but it spent time working on the Chinese space program. And it's very ambitious, and it's moving at a good clip. But, you know, this is a country that can plan 10 years out and doesn't have shifting priorities from incoming presidential administrations and so forth. So when they make plans, they keep to them, and they're accomplishing great things. The last large dump of information I read is about a year ago, and that's talking about an ever more aggressive series of robotic missions to the moon, including building a robotic, kind of a cluster of robotic probes all working together down near the South Pole. And, of course, that would have rovers included, so then you could drive further down and start prospecting if you wanted to. And just about a month ago, they announced their first robotic Mars program, which is something that's kind of become one of those ambitious goals that countries now entering spaceflight are starting to reach for. So first it was the United States. Soviet Union tried for years, still hasn't been entirely successful with either the Soviet Union or Russia. Japan has tried. China has tried once in the past. The only country besides the U.S., the European Space Agency, that's been successful at Mars so far is India, with an orbiter that they put up a couple of years ago. And it was fairly elemental, but it was able to do some good science. And they made it on the first try, which is not easy. Mars is a very, very tough target. So that appears to be next in the crosshairs of China, along with returning a sample from the moon this year.
Now, is the Wolf Amendment still in power? We're not cooperating that much with the Chinese, are we?
No, and that, yeah, you're right. That amendment, and also just the ITAR regulations in general, and that was another subject I had to work through in the book. And ITAR is thorny. You know, it's hard to understand, much less adhere to. And I work occasionally for NASA on contract, and that's something you have to be aware of there, because if you're standing on a train in a foreign country and somebody in a trench coat taps on your shoulder and starts asking you questions about privileged space information, not that I have access to much, but you got to be aware of what you're talking about. So, yeah, it does make it difficult to work with some countries, especially with China and some others that are on the particularly proscribed list. But, we had the same problem in the 1960s with the Soviet Union, where there was discussion of cooperating on the moon flights as early as, I think, 1961 or 62 between Kennedy and Khrushchev. That didn't go anywhere until 1975, and we had this cooperative Apollo-Soyuz flight. But in the early mid-1960s, the robotic missions of the two countries, the people that were flying those began having some dialogue, and that was really the first entrance into a cooperation in space. And I think it may happen that way with China, too. It may be where the stakes are a little lower, flying our robotic technology out there, that we can have that conversation start and then start cooperating on human space flight a little later.
Well, as I said, the book Space 2.0 is great. I want to talk more to you. I have to do a commercial at the bottom of the hour, but I want to come back, and I'd love to talk about when you think we'll have the first woman on the moon, and about your book, one of your books. I love all your books, but the one I really enjoy so much, and I recommended, my kids were homeschool. I homeschool them. Oh. And so I've always been looking for books that are good for homeschool, the Homeschool Association to recommend. And so I want to talk about the amazing stories of the space age.
Okay.
And I think because it is fascinating. And we'll be right back. So hold on.
This is the TAN Talk Radio Network.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more recording careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
Are you an author? An artist? An inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660. Or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
How many of you listening today yearn to write stories, poems, or novels. Each of you has a story to tell, or knows of a story that others would love to read, if only you could put the words on a page. The many writers' clubs in the Bay Area understand this urge and would welcome any new writer to learn with them. So go ahead and take the first step to becoming a well-known author. Sponsored by the Pinellas Writers Club.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Patsy with a Z, and I am back with my very, very special guest, Rod Pyle, who is now the editor-in-chief of National Space Society's magazine at Astro. And, well, and he's written so many wonderful books about space. He is a space historian. I'll let him tell you all his different titles. But his most recent book is Space 2.0, which is fantastic. And I'm just thrilled to have you here, Rod.
I'm thrilled to be here. It's fun to talk about yourself, isn't it?
Absolutely. Listen, my producer here wants to ask you a question. Big Ed, are you ready?
Yeah. Hey, Rod. In your opinion, was it time to mothball the shuttles, all of them, or should we keep a few of them around or a couple around in case of an emergency, whatever? Or did they run their course and they've become obsolete?
So that's a question that can elicit a lot of sighs from people in positions that were working on that program, because there is a split of opinion. It's a really good question. Could it have flown out longer? Yeah. Should it have? Well, you know, they were getting older. The shuttle was first initiated in the early 1970s and flown in 81. So the hardware was getting up there in age. The bigger problem, I think, and interesting, I was talking to Patsy earlier about that astronaut panel I was working with last week. We talked about the shuttle a bit, and the general consensus was, and these are people that, you know, were in a position to know, certainly, but they were a little too dangerous. You know, even from the beginning, that program was so compromised from the original plans, which were going to have a flyback first stage that was completely reusable and all these other ambitions. Part of it was Nixon didn't want to spend the money to do it properly, but part of it was just a little too big a reach for the technology at the time. It would be a challenge even now. And the shuttle, as it flew, as you saw, because we lost two of them, was a kind of a dangerous design. So I think it was probably time to stand them down as we did. I think the mistake was we should have either continued with the Constellation program, which George W. Bush started in 2004, for rockets and capsules more along the lines of Apollo, or at least got the private sector rolling a little earlier than we did. So that's really where that gap came from. And it's been an expensive 7 or 8 years, but I think we're about to round that corner.
Yeah, as Patsy said, I really hated having us to have to hitch a ride with someone else.
Yeah, but it worked. You know, the thing about the Soyuz and the Russians, they've been flying the Soyuz since 1965, that was originally, it just drips with irony. That was the spacecraft they designed to beat us to the first moon landing. That didn't work out, but we had, you know, we mothballed our magnificent Apollo technology is pretty quickly after that program was over, after it had run its course in 1972. The Russians kept flying the Soyuz, and it's flown hundreds and hundreds of times. It's proven to be very reliable, very robust. It works, and at least initially, it was inexpensive for us to hitch rides. I think as the time went on and the price went up, I don't know the exact numbers. I'm not sure anybody does, but I was talking to a couple of NASA folks about a year ago, and I said, it seems to me if the price that we're paying, if we fly one or two astronauts per flight, we're covering an awful big percentage of their costs for launching those things at all. And they kind of nodded grimly, yes, that's absolutely correct. So it is time to get back on our own hardware and start benefiting from it ourselves. So God bless these eccentric billionaires, if I can call them that, who have said, you know what? I want to build rockets. I want to do that stuff that inspired me so much when I was a young man. So I'm just going to do it because I have the money and I can. And if it wasn't for Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos and a handful of others, I don't think we'd be seeing the renaissance we're seeing right now.
Exactly. Well, Ed, that was a great question. Thank you so much. You know, How many space shuttles did they build altogether?
Five plus Enterprise, which was that was a strictly glide and approach test model. It didn't have all the heat shielding and so forth.
So the last
one was Endeavor.
Yeah. So there are three left somewhere? I mean, we didn't.
There's we have one in Los Angeles. There's one in Florida, and where's the third one? I can't remember.
New York City.
Houston really wanted one. Yeah. They didn't get it.
I remember that Houston didn't get it, and they wanted it. I'm working on a project called Forgotten F-105 Warriors, and.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, that's my project, with our mutual friend Jonathan Chambers, and we've been working on that, trying to get that up and going as a documentary on one of the networks. Unfortunately, let me just say that a few of the networks who should be doing it's a work of love because we know so many of the F-105 pilots and we want to preserve their stories, and they have been forgotten, they have been ignored, but one of the sad things is that they actually destroyed all of them. I mean, there are so few F-105s left, and I still don't understand why they had to destroy all of them, because I know there would be places where people would want to have them, you know, on exhibit. And we have such a hard time, to do a film about the F-105s, there's not one that they kept. And it's sad. So I'm, you know, at least they didn't, you know, get rid of all of the remaining shuttles.
It's surprising to me that they would have not sent at least a few of those planes to museums. That's kind of incredible. The conference I went to last week in Des Moines, the guy who puts together his name, Tony Poston, he was an F-111 pilot, and he said a couple of years ago he went out to, I guess it's New Mexico, and saw, you know, the F-105 graveyard out where the things are lined up nose to nose. He said he actually found his plane with his, you know, they paint your name on the side of it, mad dog or whatever you are, kind of fading off the side, but it's not in a museum either. It's just sitting in mothballs, and I thought, yeah, you know. They do need to keep one or two examples right place. So there aren't any F-105s anywhere?
Well, there are a few in the museums, but they've managed to get parts and things, but there's certainly not one working. And they've been trying, they tried to preserve, you know, three in working condition, but, you know, the Air Force just said, goodbye. They put them there in that graveyard, and they died, and it's a shame.
Depending on which engine it's using and so forth, keeping those things. I mean, I'm amazed there's still guys. I was at an air show down in Tucson years ago, and Michael Dorn, Star Trek, Worf, flew in his Sabre jet, and I guess the Sabre jets were so ubiquitous, and there's still so many spare parts around that you can do that, but it's amazing to me that those things are flying, you know, at those temperatures and with the turbine blades spinning that quickly and so forth. This many years later, that's pretty mind-boggling. And that's kind of the problem they're running into with the shuttle. You know, you had to keep custom fabricating and hand-repairing these parts in the engines and so forth. And at a certain point, under those incredible stresses, because getting to orbit is really tough. Getting back is tough. And it's rough on that machinery. And we called it reusable, but really the things had to have so much work done between flights and so many inspections and parts replaced and so forth. I mean, they would swap rocket engines, you know, the main engines of the back from one shuttle to the other to have it ready in time. And it really was kind of a bit of a shell game in a way, because you had to keep moving things around to keep them going. So it just got to be very challenging.
Well, now with the new program, when do they expect that we'll be able to send the first people to the moon?
Well, it depends on who. So if it's the United States, we're talking about having
United States
around the moon, and NASA orbiting station around the moon by the mid-2020s, possibly as early as 2024, although I'll be surprised if it happens on time, because things usually don't. And that's a lunar orbiting station that would be visited for a month at a time, three or four times a year with a small crew. So it's kind of like a smaller version of the International Space Station, but orbiting the moon. There's a lot of conversation going on about, is that the right thing to do? But that appears to be the direction we're headed. Now NASA recently put out a request for proposal, or for studies at least, to private industry to build landers to go between that orbiting platform and the lunar surface. So finally, it looks like we may be headed back. But then you have a couple of wild cards. You've got Blue Origin with Jeff Bezos' rocket company looking at building the Blue Moon, which is their unmanned robotic lander that can not only take cargo down the lunar surface, but can also bring cargo back to the orbiting platform or to Earth. And then you have the Chinese who are saying, you know, we're looking forward to a moon landing too, the human moon landing, because that's the next logical step, possibly as early as the mid-2030s. So there's a lot of activity headed that direction, and I think it's just a question of who pulls it together and gets it done first.
And I heard the Chinese want to send up a woman.
Well, I think everybody will, you know, because there's a whole bunch of good reasons for that. I mean, they're half of our society.
Sure, of course.
Just as intelligent and as capable as men. But the thing that's really unique is just because of female physiology, you get the same brain power, the same capabilities, the same executional capabilities in a woman for less weight. And less weight means less expense to fly and less complication and so forth. So in a lot of ways, that's kind of the ideal astronaut candidate because you get everything in a smaller, lighter package on average. So I think, and besides, it's the right thing to do, it's a smart thing to do. So I suspect within the first one or two flights back to the moon of any country, there will be women astronauts along for the ride because it just makes sense.
So is NASA still going to be the responsible one for doing the training for astronauts, even if it, you know, with...
Even if they're private,
private
companies. So at this point, in terms of humans flying on the private and entrepreneurial spacecraft, like what SpaceX is doing, these are going to be NASA-trained astronauts. There's no reason they can't fly their own astronauts and train them at SpaceX if they want to, but these first flights are being done under contract to NASA with largely NASA money paying for it, so that makes sense. Now, that said, they're getting a tremendous deal because even NASA's internal studies have said, hey, you know, SpaceX does this a lot cheaper than we could, so God bless them, we'll write them a check. But yeah, NASA will be responsible for crew selection and training in the earliest phases, and then SpaceX will undoubtedly start flying their own people. The plan is for this current system, which is the Dragon crew capsule and the Falcon 9, which is what's just been tested and will be flying in a few months, is supposed to be replaced within a few years by the big Falcon rocket, or he's now calling it Starship, out of SpaceX, which is a much larger, much more powerful rocket that is, he hopes, going to just become a regularly reusable system. And once you've got that flying, he's planning to send a private group of astronauts that will be paying for the ride on a loop around the moon in the early 2020s. That all works out, and that's pulling out all the stops, and now you've got regular people going up there on a regular basis. The FAA still has something to say about that, but yeah, they can pretty much do whatever they want.
Well, I want to mention again, before we go on to the next book, in the new book, you have an intro from Buzz Aldrin.
Yeah.
Isn't that nice?
Isn't that cool?
It is. I read it twice, you know. I read it once, and then I said, oh, this is just so good. I have to read it again. I love that. I love the intro. He did a great job.
He did, and he is on the Board of Governors of the National Space Society, which certainly smoothed the way towards doing that, because a couple of interviews have done this. Said, how did you get Buzz? You know, what's the secret sauce? The secret sauce was that he had been involved with this organization that I had been involved with. He had been involved since, I think, 1982, or so, and I got involved in 1985, and had that connection not been there, it would have been more challenging. He was very gracious to do so. I mean, it, of course, enhances your brand, but it's also, he's the right guy, I think, to have that message from, and that message was, in essence, you know, we had a great history, I remember very fondly, let's get moving. You know, this has been taking too long, and it's time to get back in the game. So that's hopefully what we're looking at right now, and I think that pivot point for me was when I saw the launch of the Falcon Heavy. You know,
wow.
Private billionaire says, I want to build this enormous rocket. We've been building up to this a long time. But I feel like that sort of brought us across the threshold into this new space age, or space 2.0, because it was just spectacular.
Well, and we lived for a while in Daytona, so we went to a lot of the launches. And It's always so exciting. It's just you don't get over it. You know, the thrill of seeing a takeoff. It's quite amazing. Now,
And the shuttle launches were spectacular, but how incredible is it going to be to go to a Falcon Heavy launch? There's six sonic booms. These things are coming back to land. I just think that's sensational.
Well, I didn't ask you, but when you were a space fanatic when you were a kid?
Because I was born just a little bit before the space age, 1956, so I was able to grow up watching these incredible missions of Apollo fly off to the moon as often as every 10 weeks, you know, and we were running out there to explore the mountains and the valleys and the craters, and it was an incredible time to be alive because of the convergence of technology and national will. I was able to watch it on TV until, I might add, Apollo 14, when the networks thought, you know, we've been there a couple of times, we've seen this stuff, it's clear we're not going to have a threat to their lives like we did on Apollo 13. And right in the middle of the Apollo 14 moonwalk, they cut away to daytime soap operas and reruns of sitcoms and so forth. I was aghast. I thought, how can you give this up so quickly? But, you know, the Nielsen ratings said that people don't want to watch Space Hawk. They want to watch General Hospital. So that was a tough moment there.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I want to recommend Space 2.0, how private spaceflight, a resurgent NASA and international partners are creating a new space age. And, you know, it's available wherever books are sold, I'm sure, also in real bookstores even, because it is a beautiful book. And with this lovely, lovely introduction, I think I hope it's a big seller, because I want people to be as enthusiastic about space travel as I am, and about just about the whole process of what men and women are capable of accomplishing when they set their minds to it. And that's why I love your other book, Amazing Stories of the Space Age: True Tales of Nazis in Orbit. Soldiers, you love long titles. Okay. Amazing stories.
It's what the publishers request, yeah.
Well, you're going to grab all the readers. Amazing Stories of the Space Age: True Tales of Nazis in Orbit, Soldiers on the Moon, Orphan Martian Robots, and Other Fascinating Accounts from the Annals of Space Flight. Wow. This is a great book. When I got that book, there were things that I didn't know about. I vaguely knew a little bit about the space Nazi thing, but there were so many stories in here. Let's talk about a few of them and maybe a few of your favorites, because I just think that book is wonderful.
So the subtitle was Publisher's Choice. And we went back and forth quite a bit on that. I was a little nervous because, you know, claiming that Nazis went into orbit is not a good thing to do. But you can say that they had hoped to. So that was Project Silverbird, and that was begun in the 1930s. And the idea was, you know, we're beginning to refine rocket engine design, and we kind of understand the very basic rudiments of supersonic and hypersonic flight, at least in theory. You know, can we build a powerful enough rocket plane that would launch on rails just like those lovely things did in the sci-fi movies of the 1950s, which is, of course, where they got the idea from, and make it up almost to orbit? The idea was to skip across the atmosphere all the way to the United States, drop bombs, of course, because it was Nazi Germany, and, you know, what's the point of that technology if you can't go kill people with it? So that was the idea. It probably wouldn't have worked. You know, the calculations were very optimistic, and there was just an awful lot of the science and engineering that wasn't really understood at the time. And even had it made it up to near orbital velocities, as far as we could tell, just from looking at the original plans coming back, it would have probably melted and broken up. But, you know, that doesn't mean that they wouldn't have tried. I mean, they tried a lot of other kind of crazy extreme things.
And they got some rockets across the channel.
Well, they lots of them, yeah, and without people in them, too.
Yeah.
They didn't need pilots. And the whole idea behind Silverbird was it would be piloted by a single guy. He would re-enter over New York, drop this enormous conventional explosive, or if they had developed their atomic weapons at the time, an atomic bomb on Manhattan, and then either try and get the plane to glide far enough to land in Japanese-held territory in the Pacific, or bail out over the U.S. and sacrifice the rocket bomber. So it was pretty ambitious. It was a stretch. Hitler backed it for a number of years, and then finally it was just time to move on because they had other fish to fry, as it were, in the European War. I think another really fun story was the soldiers on the moon story, which is late 1950s. We're seeing the Soviet Union very successful at launching their satellites. These satellites are getting bigger and bigger. They're getting to be about the size and weight of what it would take to carry the atomic weapons of the age, and the West is getting very nervous. So one of our responses to that was to have people, including Wernher von Braun, who famously developed the Saturn V for Apollo, make a study, a plan to put a base on the moon. So they were going to station, I think it was 20 soldiers up there, and they had, again, this very optimistic, this is the Army, by the way, not the Air Force, this very optimistic notion of how quickly they could launch large habitation vessels up onto the moon. And yeah, we'll launch them up there, we'll land them, we'll send a crew up to assemble them, they'll have a crane, how hard can it be? Well, we found out by the end of the next decade it's really hard, and you have to have 363-foot high rockets just to get a capsule that's 13 feet tall with three guys in it to the moon and back. But the plans for the moon base were very optimistic, and they even included Claymore mines that were specially rated for use on the moon and an atomic bazooka, because we figured once we got there, the Russians would do the same and we'd be having fights over land on the moon. But thank God that never happened.
Well, as I said, this book, it's just a fun read. I always love to hear about, you know, people's schemes and plans and what they tried to do or thought they could do. And well, one of them, I love the name. I thought this is nice. Das Mars Project. Das.
Yes. Das Mars Project was Wernher von Braun's plan. Now, that actually dates back to the 40s. So von Braun, as you know, developed the V2 rocket, Germany, during World War II. And then at the end of the war, you know, not only were the Russians closing in from one direction and the Allies closing in from the other direction on what was left of Germany, but there was also a fairly strong sense that what was left of the Nazi Reich was not going to allow people like von Braun to survive the war, because they wanted their secrets to die with them. So von Braun talked to his circle of Confederates at the time, which numbered, I think, about 140, 150 people, and said, well, we can surrender to the Russians, the Americans. What do you think? Well, the Russians were pretty angry. They had a bad time in World War II, as had we, but not to that extent, nearly. So he sent out his brother Magnus to flag down an American officer and try to explain to him that the guys who had developed these rockets that had been blasting the heck out of London and Antwerp wanted to surrender. It took a while. They put it together. So before you know it, von Braun and his allies, or his comrades, are stationed in White Sands, New Mexico. And they're flying out what's left of the V-2s as a research program for the U.S. Army. But he had a lot of time on his hands. So he said, I'm going to write a science fiction novel. So he wrote a pretty awful novel, complete with cheap romance and a guy driving a Jaguar in it. It was unpublishable until just a few years ago. In fact, it was never published. But the appendix for that novel was this technical explanation of how they could do a Mars program.
Well, you know, I have to stop you because I could listen to you for hours. And as a matter of fact, I want to make sure I tell everyone that you have a website. It's called pilebooks.com. They can read all about you there and find out all the exciting things that you're doing. You have a lot of podcasts there, which are fascinating. I love your podcast. I love where you have, you know, all sorts of space music and Captain Kirk. you make me
that
laugh.
That was an experiment. That,
I love all of that. And so everybody, go to Rod's website. It's called pilebooks.com. And you have a book coming out in May?
I have a bunch of books coming out this year. So Space 2.0 just came out. Interplanetary Robots came out in January. In April, my Apollo 11 book comes out. Then in May, another one called Heroes of the Space Age comes out.
So what does that mean? That means that you have to come back to Joy on Paper, because you certainly have found a lot of joy on paper, and you're very funny. And I, as I said, I just love listening to your podcast. And I want to thank you so much, Rod Pyle, for coming on Joy on Paper today, because you certainly are fascinating. And next time we'll talk about all of the important things that you've worked on over the years. Okay.
Outstanding. Thank you so much for having me.
Okay. Bye bye, Rod. Great talking to you. Wow. That's nice. He's a great guy. His website is filled with recordings of his different radio and podcasts. Very funny. You'll just get a kick out of him. It's a great way to learn about what's happening in the world of space, because he has updates and funny things and just wonderful stories. So as I wanted to mention before I leave, that April 1st is the deadline for the self-published authors to submit their books to Writer's Digest. Please, if you've published a book, try. You don't know. You never know which famous literary agent or famous New York City agent or New York City editor will be reading your story, your book. And they might just fall in love with it and you could win. Maybe not the first prize, but some prize. And in any case, you'll get a wonderful, wonderful analysis of your book that you will really learn a great deal from. So the deadline is April 1st. Go to writersdigest.com and submit your book. And you never know. Because as I have told you all, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book. Or if you're really lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a film. And as I just want to say one more time, get Carol J. Perry's Final Exam. That's her most recent book. And then you'll be able to say, I read her books before she got her deal on television for a miniseries, because I really believe in her. She started with Joy on Paper. She was my first guest in the studio, and it's coming up to 4-year anniversary of Joy on Paper. So I want to thank Carol for being my first guest and to tell her how much I appreciate her support over the years. And please go to my webpage, radio-joyonpaper, and check out some of the interviews I've had during, I've interviewed hundreds and hundreds of authors. It's really quite amazing. I'm still in shock. So please do that. And also go to my Facebook page and like me, and I will like you and all of that kind of stuff, because it's important. Anyway, again, thank you all for all of your nice messages to me. I really appreciate it. And I've got some wonderful guests coming up. But on Thursday is Bill Larson, and he is our legal eagle. He will answer your legal questions. So if you have any, go to my webpage and fill in the form, and I will have Bill answer your questions again. Bye-bye now. Say something nice to somebody today. I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thanks for jumping in today with this interview. It was a great question, and I'm so grateful to him. He's saluting me. I'm saluting him. Bye-bye now.